Welcome. This is Cascade Church Portland's podcast. We exist to invite all people to join us as we follow Jesus together in bringing heaven to earth.
Okay, I love seeing the kids in church. And probably one of my highlights that I just love more than anything is before and after church when I see the kids running around and, you know, running through the church. I just love that. Because they are forming positive associations with church, which means they're going to have positive associations with God. And really, their time and feeling safe and accepted and loved is going to really follow them throughout their church days. And my husband and I were both really blessed to grow up in the church, similar backgrounds, and we often share stories about, you know, what it was like to be a kid back in the 50s and 60s growing up in church. And sometimes when we're out and about, we will just rip in, like not out and about, but in our car. We'll rip into songs from when we were kids, and we'll laugh, and we'll talk about. Remember when Sister Jones would sing, and she always had the vibrato? You guys, any of you old enough to remember the vibrato? Because they had back then specials, and many of them were really special. You know what I mean? So sometimes there's a lot of songs I would never want to sing in church again. But sometimes they just bring comfort and old songs, and sometimes they make me happy. Like, every day's a happy day with Jesus in my heart. Anybody nod if you sang that one? Or every day with Jesus is sweeter than the day before. One of my favorite is I've got the joy, 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 joy down in my heart. Our kids still sing that. My favorite verse is that if the devil doesn't like it, he'll set on attack. I bet that just scares him down to his boots. But Ray and I, because we've been married a long time, we like to tease and laugh. And I grew up in California in the 50s and 60s. In the 60s, you know, in California, it was the place that things were happening, the hippies, you know, we were grooving and moving. It was Age of Aquarius. And, you know, I was pretty hip and cool. For a good church girl, I was, you know, not real way out there at all. But Ray grew up in Klamath Falls in Montana, and I don't think the 60s hit Klamath Falls and Montana till about late 80s, early 90s. So I like to, you know, tell him that he doesn't know, he didn't experience the 60s. And I have a case in point, because when we talk about songs, we know all the old songs, and, you know, like, I remember people's telephone numbers and zip codes, but Ray remembers every old song in the church he ever heard. And there's one of them that I never heard, and this proves my point, that Klamath Falls and Montana were just a little backward. So I even called Ray. He's in Kansas. He's doing some consulting work for the church that we pastored in Kansas for 20 years. And I would like to read for you. I won't sing it. Telephone to Glory. Now, this actually was sung in the churches that Ray grew up in. And some of you are too young to understand some of the words. I'll tell you later if you want to know. This is a true song. Central's never busy, always on the line. You can talk to heaven almost any time. 'Tis a royal service for his loved and own. You can talk to Jesus on the royal telephone. Telephone to Glory, oh, what joy divine. I can feel the current moving on the line. 'Tis a royal service for his loved and own. You can talk to Jesus on the royal telephone. Isn't that great? Thank you. Thank you. I'm sure, you know, if you really want to hear the song version, just ask Ray next week, and nobody sings it like him. But, you know, it's interesting that a lot of the songs we grew up with and a lot of the songs our kids are growing up now will have a lot to inform how they feel about God and their relationship with God. And the other day when I was whipping into some of these good old songs, like Every Day's a Happy Day with Jesus in My Heart, or Every Day with Jesus is Sweeter Than the Day Before, or even I've Got the Joy, 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 Joy Down in My Heart, there's a subtle message that I think I picked up. You know, maybe they preached a sermon or two, I don't know, but I picked up somewhere a subtle message. Now, last week, Pastor Kurt talked about prosperity gospel. And I would have sworn up and down that I did not believe in the prosperity gospel. And I would told you that I did not believe in name it and claim it. But what I did believe was that if you committed your life to Jesus, you would be happy and blessed and successful. and that you wouldn't really have any problems, you wouldn't have to suffer, and that if I was faithful and obedient, Jesus would reward me. We could avoid pain and avoid discomfort and surely avoid suffering. After all, Jesus suffered, so I wouldn't have to. I know I heard that one. Have you ever heard somebody saying, I'm too blessed to be stressed and too anointed to be disappointed? Has anybody ever heard that one? But what happens, and it sounds really, on the surface, it can sound kind of, like, wow, that person has it all together. But what happens when you are very disappointed with your life, maybe very disappointed even in your walk with Jesus, and you are way too stressed to feel blessed at all? When these things happen, often we can have a couple ways that we respond to them. We can think, what happened? What's wrong with me? Because I believe that if I did everything right, if I was the good Christian girl, if I followed all the rules, just give me the rules and I'll follow them. Because I wanted to avoid discomfort and pain and suffering like nobody's business. And so when bad things happen, I can have the philosophy, I've been tended to have the philosophy or the mindset, the notion, what's wrong with me? What did I not do right? Now, some of you, because I'm neurotic, I always think what's wrong with me. But others of you might say, what's wrong with God? And you do more of a blame thing. Did God let me down? And when we're happy and successful, honestly, if you're honest with yourself, I think it's really hard not to think that you had something to do with it. Of course, we would give God the glory, and we would thank him, because that's the right thing to do. But it's hard not to think that I made the right choices. I followed the rules. And this is who I am. And I am being rewarded or reaping the benefits of making the right decisions. It's honestly hard not to think this way in some ways, because this is the way our whole world system is built on. It's a world system built on transactions, like Pastor Kurt talked about last week, or on merit-based system, that good hard work will be rewarded. If we do the right things, things will turn out. And this is not a new phenomenon just in our culture, which is so merit-based and so transactional. It's been a part of life since the beginning. It's kind of can turn into be kind of a slot machine mentality, kind of like a spiritual slot machine. And I've been thinking about this a lot. And even prayer, we can approach prayer almost like it's a slot machine. I put in my prayer, I put in my good works, maybe I even give to the church, maybe I even volunteer, and cha-ching, something good should come out of it, right? It's hard not to think that. And Paul, who wrote quite a bit of the New Testament, wrote to the church in Rome, in the book of Romans, and he warned them about this, and he said, do not conform to the patterns of this world. When I used to first chew on that scripture, I thought that meant just to be away from all the evil of the world, all that evil out there. There's a lot of evil in the world, but to me that meant bad behavior, not going to movies and not drinking and not smoking and not going to dances or not cheating or lying or committing adultery, not disobeying the Ten Commandments. But I think it's so much more than that. I think evil comes out of not necessarily just a bad behavior, but a bad thinking. And it's this pattern of the world system. I like the translation from one of the very first new translations. It said, do not be squeezed into the world's mold. And if we're honest today, every one of us in the church have to fight against that temptation to be squeezed into the world's mold. So what is the world system? It's that marketplace mentality that things will satisfy you and make you happy. And that everything and everyone can be fixed, controlled, or manipulated. And if we can just fix, control, and manipulate our world, we can be happy and avoid pain. What happens often with this, rather than loving people and using things, we begin to use people and love things. And we can develop a sense of entitlement that I have a right to these things. But this was not always God's intention. When he first created human beings, he created them in his very image, just like he does today. And that knowing that they were created in the image of God gave them their identity. They were not who they were, not what they did. They were who they were, which was a created being loved by an almighty God. This gave them a sense of completeness and oneness with God. I can't even imagine what that would have been like to walk and talk with God when they just found their significance in who they were. It was based a relationship where they were humans created in the image of God. And I think the temptation, which we often call the fall in Genesis 3, wasn't so much about bad behavior, that they did something wrong, but that they rejected their humanity. They rejected their frailties and their dependency on God and their oneness with God. The lie they believed by the tempter was, you're not enough. You got to add something to it. You got to do and do and do. And they believed it, and we believe it. You must find your meaning and your value and identity on your own, separate from your relationship with God. Basically, you must become a separate self. Now, we that are Christians and followers of Christ would say that's not true. I don't separate myself from my relationship with God. But even think about your image that you have of yourself. Is it being a good Christian? Is it being a faithful person? Is it a person that, even those things, when they're not in dependency on God, they can become a separate self. And so they believed that it wasn't enough to be human. It wasn't enough to be a limited dependent on God. And so shame developed and blame developed and judging. And I heard a quote recently that really kind of opened my eyes, that one of the reasons we judge people is so we can feel better about ourselves. That's defending who we are and feeling superior. So what happened is kind of a split occurred, and this false self was created. And rather than embracing the wonder of being a child of God with his very own image imprinted on us, his very own divine DNA, we began to focus on that separate self that we created. This talk about, much of the talk I'm going to do today about the false self comes from, it was originated by a Catholic priest in the 60s named Thomas Merton. And much of his teaching has informed Richard Rohr, who is a Catholic priest that teaches today, and also Robert Mulholland, who is a professor at Asbury Seminary. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the false self. And this is very much a biblical teaching. It just has a name that maybe is a little bit easier for us to grasp. What is the false self? It's the external self that we project. It's the superficial, the outward, the exterior. It's our reputation, our ego. Now, we need to have an ego, but the problem is when it becomes the all-encompassing point of our life. We begin to think that we are what we do. And we begin to believe that we are not only who we think we are, we believe that we are who you think we are, because it matters to us so much what others think of us. We can become that false self is easily hurt, easily offended, easily gets angry. And if our heart and our minds don't change from this mindset, we will continue to be upset and frustrated and disappointed much of our lives. We tend to make the ego and the false self the most important thing, believing that that's all that there is. The false self isn't bad, because when I first heard this teaching, I thought, ooh, evil false self, must get rid of false self. It is the raw material for life. It's the entry point. I like to think of it kind of like those M&Ms that we passed out today. And this is an illustration that I learned from a professor I had at Fox, George Fox, or now Portland Seminary, Katie Skurja. And she talks about the peanut M&M. So I want you to think of yourself of a peanut M&M. And you can eat those, but I'd like you to at least save one. You can eat candy in church if you want to. I said so. Oh, they're almond. I'm sorry. Thank you, Kurt. They're almond in case you have a peanut allergy. If you have a nut allergy, we're sorry. We're kind of like a peanut M&M, or an almond M&M, rather. And we have a candy coating, and that's our false self. Now, it's important to have a container, a shell, an outer shell. It's kind of like, I think of it as a container, or like a box. You have to have a container to hold something precious, right? But often we start putting the value on the container, the outer shell, and not the preciousness that is held inside. And that's the danger of the false self, is when we get preoccupied with the outer shell and to the exclusion and the detriment of what is held inside. Richard Rohr says that we are people of the circumference. And I think that is true. So much we live in the shadows, the outside. And we don't really live from within the deep core of who we are. And that's the nut, the thing that's really valuable, the inner core of who we are, where God's presence dwells within us. And so just as peanut M's get cracked easy, maybe some of yours are cracked, I don't know. If you bit into a little bit, it'd be cracked. What happens when our outer shell gets cracked? We try to patch it up. We try to slap a fresh coat of paint on it. And what the danger is we can think that the candy coating is the most important thing, the exterior is the most important thing, and not realize that there's more. Now, this might be something you've never heard before in church, probably. Jesus came to tell us that there's more. Jesus came to reveal what's inside that candy shell. I bet you never heard that before. Jesus came to show us our true identity, our true self. And he did it by absolutely turning up the world system. Because even the Jewish system was based on merit. If you look at the Old Testament promises, they were very conditional. If you do this, then you will get this. If you follow me and my commandments, you will be rewarded. And if you don't, this is what will happen. That's a transactional, merit-based system. And Jesus came to totally turn that side upside down. And there's a wonderful name for that, and it's called grace. You know, we think we know what grace means. We throw that term around almost like we do love and mercy. But I hope today maybe you'll have a different revelation about grace. You know, as I was praying and talking to the prayer team today, I'm going to give you lots of information. But unless the Holy Spirit gives you revelation, it won't really make a difference. So I'm really praying today that those people that are ready and want to can have a fresh revelation about grace today. Grace is not about our worthiness or our performance or our possessions. And grace is not running from our shame or denying our shame. It's not about covering up shame with a fresh coat of paint, but facing the shame. It's about letting go of all of that and surrendering to our inherent dignity, that deep imago Dei that's planted within us. And it's finding freedom and happiness without controlling and fixing. It is so radical that Jesus said there's only one way we can get it, and that is to die. It's to die to that old system of transactional, merit-based system. To die to all of that and raise to the new life. And it's a process. It's not a once and done. You don't say a prayer and that's it. It's a process. And unfortunately, there's a lot of believers that have gotten frustrated and discouraged along the way and have given up. Of course, they still believe in God and they still come to church, but they've given up because they believed in the transactional system and they got frustrated when it was harder and harder. This is because they don't understand the paradox of the kingdom. And the paradox of the kingdom is that if you want to have life, you have to give it up. If you want to live, you must die. We don't do paradox well. We don't do mystery well. And that is really sad. You know, back in the early beginnings of Christianity, especially where it developed in the East, and even in Eastern Eastern Christianity today, they still embrace a lot of paradox and mystery. And I think because we live in the Western world where we want everything black and white, we want everything, you know, if we can't prove it, then we won't believe it. But I think one of the wonderful switches, I guess, or I don't know if that's the right word, one of the wonderful things that's happening in a lot of Western churches is that we're beginning to embrace mystery and paradox. And the Bible is full of mystery and paradox. There are a lot of things that if you read them really with fresh eyes, what is Jesus talking about, if you're really honest with it? But we don't do paradox well. That's because the false self hates it. The false self loves to be the either or, the all or nothing. But the kingdom is full of paradox. And that's probably why the disciples didn't get it. Jesus talked about death a whole bunch. He predicted his death 3 times on the way to Jerusalem. And if we look today, let's look in Mark 8, 34 and 35. This was the passage that Pastor Kurt preached on 2 weeks ago. Whoever wants to be my disciples must deny themselves, take up their cross, and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me and the gospel will save it. And then in John 12, 24, he says, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it will bear fruit. This mystery, if you want life, there must be death. Today's passage, we have Jesus predicting his death for the third and final time. And I think it's so interesting that Jesus' prediction happens right in the middle of 2 accounts of people that Jesus is basically inviting them to join him in his death. You know, it's interesting that Jesus never told his disciples to worship him. Isn't that interesting? Some, when I heard that in a sermon one time, I go, wait a minute. And I thought about it, went back to this, right, Jesus never said worship me. He said, follow me. And it is so much easier to worship Jesus than to follow Jesus. We worship really easy. There's not a lot of cost, but following is another thing. He tells him to follow him to his death. So in today's, we're in chapter 10. The first prediction was in 8, then it was in 9, and then today we look in 10. And we start out with a story that we commonly call the story of the rich young ruler. In 10:17. We have it on the screen, or you can follow along with your Bible app or the Bible. As Jesus started on his way, a man ran up to him and fell on his knees before him. Good teacher, he asked, what must I do to inherit eternal life? I'm going to verse 19. You know the commandments, Jesus said. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not give false testimony. You shall not defraud. You shall honor your mother and father. Teacher, he declared, all these things I have done since I was a boy. Jesus looked at him and loved him. I think that's the coolest part of this passage. Jesus didn't look at him and shame him. Jesus looked at him and loved him. One thing you lack, he said, go sell everything you have and give to the poor. And then come, you will have treasure in heaven. Then come follow me. At this, the man's face fell. He went away sad because he had great wealth. The rich young ruler, I used to read about the rich young ruler and think, he must have been really greedy. He wouldn't follow Jesus. He wouldn't get rid of his wealth. What kind of bad person was he? But as I look at it again, I think what he's saying is, Lord, I want to do what's right. I've been trying to follow you ever since I was a child. Just tell me, what do I need to do next? And I can so relate to that. He was finding his identity and his security in his wealth. He wasn't some kind of arrogant schmuck. I think that's what I used to think about then. He was just a schmuck. And I would think, I would never do that. You know, if Jesus asked me to give everything, I would do that. But it wasn't that he was greedy. It was that he found his identity in all these things. I think he found his identity in being a good Jewish boy. He found his identity in his wealth and what people thought of him. He was terrified to give up control of his false self, his exterior self, separate self apart from God. He was a good guy. He was probably even generous. But he was terrified to give up that false self. And when you think about the security of the false self and that peanut, the almond M&M, that thin candy shell is pretty thin. It's not something that we want to put our dependency on. And then we read Jesus' third and final prediction in Mark 10, 32 and 34. They were on their way to Jerusalem, and that was astonishing to the disciples because they knew that if they went to Jerusalem that it wasn't probably going to be pretty because the Pharisees were there and they were plotting against Jesus. And they were confused why Jesus would want to go to Jerusalem in the first place. So they were on their way to Jerusalem with Jesus leading the way, and the disciples were astonished, while those who followed were afraid. Again, he took the 12 aside and told them what was going to happen. "We are going up to Jerusalem," he said, "and the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and the teachers of the law. They will condemn him to death and will hand him over to the Gentiles, who will mock him and spit on him and flog him and kill him, and 3 days later he will die." That was Jesus' prediction of his death, his third and final prediction. He says, "I will die, but then I will rise." This was like astonishing. What does he mean, "I will rise"? There will be death, but there will be a resurrection. And then right after this, I want you to catch the poignancy of this. Right after Jesus says, "This is going to happen to me. I'm going to suffer. I'm going to die." Like, if you were with your best friend, your closest friend, and they just said this was going to happen, like, I think they couldn't handle the tension of the moment. And so, like, okay, let's get the focus again, something sad, and let's focus on something happy. And so, right there in verse 35, right after Jesus says 3 days later he will rise, then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to him. "Teacher," they said, "we want you to do for us whatever we ask." I bet that made Jesus chuckle. "What do you want me to do for you?" he asked. They replied, "Let one of us sit at your right and the other at your left in your glory." "You don't know what you are asking," Jesus said. He said, "Can you drink the cup I drink, or be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with?" "They can." "We can," they said. Jesus said to them, "You will drink the cup I drink and be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with, but to sit at my right or the left is not for me to grant. These places belong to those who belong to those for whom it has been prepared." And then the other ones were indignant with them when they heard what they had asked Jesus. And Jesus says, "Whoever wants to be great among you must become a servant, and whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. For the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom." They had just heard Jesus say, "If you want to be my disciple, you have to die, and that the first will be last." And the next thing that they focus on is, how can we be applauded and lauded? It had to do with their identity. Jesus invited them to die, and that was too scary. They wanted to find their meaning and identity in who they were and what they did instead of who they were. And so death is necessary. We will not stop on our false self as long as we get something from it. And the reason that we keep on being people of the circumference and fixating on our false self, our image self, the self we create, is that we get something from it. We get attention, we get reinforcement, we get applause, we get that feeling that we're doing it all right. Our egos will continue opposing and fixing and controlling as long as theirs pay off. But when we suffer loss, when there's a great enough disappointment, when there is failure or humiliation, we start to look at things differently. We have a choice either to crazily reinforce our false self, or we can decide to die. Richard Rohr calls this a necessary suffering. And I love that, because there comes a time in our life, I thought we never had to suffer as believers. Isn't that crazy? I don't know if any of the rest of you have ever bought into that, but I thought if I did everything right, I wouldn't have to suffer. And I, for many, many years, obsessively tried to do all the right things so that no bad thing would come to me or my family. But there's a necessary suffering that comes. Does Jesus bring this necessary suffering? I don't think so. I think life just happens. There's a worship song that we used to sing a while ago, and it said, when the oceans rage, I don't have to be afraid. And that always hit me. It wasn't like, if the oceans rage, I don't have to be afraid, but when the oceans rage. Every one of us in our life, if you're too young, maybe it hasn't happened to you, but if you live long enough, bad things are going to happen to you. There are going to be oceans and that are going to rage in your life. Death leads to transformation, and I think that is the beauty and the wonder of Easter, that death leads to resurrection. You know, when a person dies, if you've had the privilege of being with someone, then they give their last, often they hang on. They hang on for a long time. And you might have heard somebody say, I think they're hanging on until their son or daughter gets here, or they're hanging on until their sister gets here. Or maybe they're just hanging on because they know a loved one doesn't want them to go. And then you hear stories of after that person comes and they kind of say goodbye, or after their loved one says, you know, it's okay, we'll be all right, you can go, that they just let go. And what do you hear after that? They're so peaceful after that. And so dying leads to liberation, to being at peace and being free. It looks like loss, it looks like death, but it's really transformation. You can even see this in nature. It is depicted all around us. Unless the grain of wheat dies, it'll continue just being a grain of wheat. But when the grain of wheat falls into the ground by itself and dies, only then can it become wheat. A few weeks ago when Scott Erickson was here, he talked about the caterpillar that has the DNA of being a butterfly. The seed, the grain of wheat, has the DNA of being wheat, even when it's just a grain of wheat, just a seed. But it has to die for that to emerge, for it to come forth. That outer shell has to die and crumble and to be let go of so that the real essence of what it was created to be comes forth. And that's how it is very, very much like us. We have to die to having our identity in that outer false self for the true self to come forth and emerge. We cannot strive this into being any more than the grain of wheat can strive it into being, or the caterpillar can strive itself into becoming a butterfly. I think most of what we call Christian discipleship actually can reinforce our false self, because it defends and promotes the exterior self, and we can look like we're doing everything right, and it never touches that false self or the ego. I think that was what was wrong with me, or what happened to me. I had so many years of being reinforced about fixating on my performance and looking good and doing the right thing and pleasing people that it just reinforced my false self instead of and never let me touch, really get to transformation. But this death is more of surrender, of letting go. It's letting go of the false self and surrendering to the true self. Surrendering to that imago Dei, to love and to grace. It's letting go of that candy shell and realizing that there is more. About 7 years ago, I faced my necessary suffering. And it was a time where, as Richard Doris says, my own personal salvation project failed me. My own spiritual self-help, spiritual upward mobility was failing me. And it was a time where it was a season, the last 7 years have been a season of losses. And just when I have thought that it can't get any worse, it's gotten worse. But when it first started about 7 years ago, my perky, positive, faith-filled, false self thought it could handle it. But then my own personal salvation project began to fail me as the losses began to be too great. And the holes in my exterior, in my candy shell, the cracks turned into holes that were so big that you could drive a truck through. And I look back at this time, even though it was painful, the last 7 years have been painful, but I see it as the grace of God, because it allowed me to let go of those things that I clung on so desperately that I felt were my sense of identity. I was so much like the rich young ruler that I had done all these things, but it wasn't enough. I tried so hard to avoid pain, but there came a point, and I remember a turning point, March 1st, 2012, 5 years ago. There came a point where my anxiety that I was denying I was anxious, because I couldn't be anxious, because that would mean I wasn't a strong Christian. My anger turned to rage because I didn't want to admit I was angry. And my sadness was going into depression because I wasn't admitting that I was sad. And I was on my day off, and some of you have heard this story before. I was on my day off, and I was sitting on my couch, and all of these emotions, the rage, the anger, the sadness, are just overwhelming to me. And Friday night at Webinar, we talked about hitting the wall. Boy, did I hit the wall. And I just started to scream. But I had this peace that it was okay, and it was part of God. God was very much in the midst of it. And I just screamed at the top of my lungs. And if somebody had walked in, they might have thought that a crazy person was losing it. But I had the sense that it was a necessary thing. It's kind of hard to explain, but I knew it was okay. And I screamed at the top of my lungs, and then out came these words: I hate you, I hate you, I hate you. And I kind of like was shocked that that came out. And I kind of said to myself, who are you? Who do you hate? And then the other thing that came out is, I hate myself because I'm not perfect. And then I just began to sob and sob, because the truth came out. The lie had been exposed. And I got down on my knees and wept. And I realized that I'd been trying to be God, that I'd been trying to live a separate life, and even all my goodness and all my serving God had been a separate self trying to do all these things. I guess I surrendered being in control and propping up this false self. I let that go, day that go, and began to let grace come in. And I'm quoting Richard Rohr a lot, but I've just read so much of him, and it's been so helpful. He says that grace is the consummate threat to self-hatred. I love that. Grace is the consummate threat to self-hatred. So that was a beginning, but the next 5 years, I would see more of my exterior crumble. And I resisted. But in the last 5 years, in the last 2 years, have probably been some of the most difficult, but I saw my job crumble, my position, my privilege that I saw as privilege, my ministry, my church family, my financial security, my home, what I perceived as my influence. And many of my closest relationships that I felt secure in, some of those actually abandoned and betrayed me. And then I just lost some of them because I just wasn't around anymore. It was a time of great disappointment, devastation, and some despair. My security is gone. Who was I anymore? I wasn't a pastor anymore. I wasn't Janet Cotton anymore. I took a job last fall, and it was humbling because I guess I was arrogant. And I took a job as only a teacher's aide. You know, I had more education than the teacher did, but I was her aide, and she's 22 and I'm 62. That was humbling. It was humbling to people, teachers, they call it an instructional assistant, but it's really a teacher's aide. That was hard for me to swallow. And when I went to the school, I realized those people don't know I'm Janet Cotton. They could give a rip that I was Janet Cotton. But what I really meant was they don't know me for what I do. And that's what I clung to. Even though I don't think I'm an overtly arrogant person, I still was putting my significance and my worth in what I did and what people thought of me. It was a scary and fearful place. But it's kind of like when the butterfly goes into the cocoon or the chrysalis. It has to die to being a caterpillar. Death is necessary. And sometimes suffering is the thing that you need to expose it. When the caterpillar goes into the chrysalis, I don't know, I did some research on it because I've been fascinated by the transformation, the metamorphosis. In the scripture in Romans 12, where it says, do not be conformed to this world, it says be transformed. That word means metamorphosis, just like the transformation of a butterfly. For that transformation to happen inside the hiddenness of that cocoon, and I tell you, the last 2 years, I felt very hidden and isolated, but it was a necessary time of being hidden with Christ. The heat inside that cocoon is so hot that caterpillar turns to liquid. It is so hot for the transformation. And I think sometimes the suffering that life brings can feel like that, but it's a good thing. It's a good death. It's a good transformation. I realize that I'm not defined by my successes, and I'm not defined by my failures. And that's part of the paradox of the gospel. I'm defined by who God says I am. I am loved. I wish I had more time, because this is probably the most important part of the message. If you'd like my notes, you can have them. I'm learning to embrace that I am an imperfect person with frailties. I just have to tell you that every time I speak, I have to live the message. I hate that. I'm glad I don't speak very often. And even though I've died to a lot of this stuff, of trying to, it's like a daily, you know, Paul says, I die daily. And I think it is one of my practices now is every day I kind of see myself going from the outer shell of the candy coating. And then that chocolate part is the messy shame part. And we have to go through it. You can't avoid it. You can't deny it. You can't run from it. You have to face it. And the wonderful thing about it is when you start facing it, you realize it's okay. It does not define you. The truth of the matter are we are failed, fallen, broken people who make mistakes, and that is okay. And I think that's the message of grace. Even though I'm a failure, because I fail sometimes, even though if I'm afraid, even though I'm weak, I am loved and accepted by God. Even though I am weak, a failure, make mistakes, disappoint, I love and accept myself. That is part of my daily practice. And so I just wasn't planning to share this, but I will. So I was really struggling with anxiety. The old self would have run from that. I would have run from the anxiety. I would have procrastinated. I would have done anything not to face anxiety. I realize I have a terrible problem with procrastination. And I'm realizing it's because at the core of that is fear. And so I procrastinate because I have a fear that I won't be good enough, that my message won't be good enough. And if I don't get started, I don't have to face the fact that I might not be good enough. And so almost every day this week, I asked myself every day, are you mad? Are you sad? Are you anxious? And like, yeah, I don't want to admit it. Shoot. But I'm anxious about speaking. And when I peel back all the layers, like, what are you afraid of? That I won't be good enough. Well, what's wrong with that? So what? You're human. You're not going to be the best speaker in the whole world. And even if you are, you're still human. There's somebody better than you. And even yesterday, I had anxiety. And like, so what if you're not like all that great? And then it was like, I don't want to disappoint. I don't want to disappoint the people. And so it was just like embracing that. And so even though I might not do the most fantastic job in the world, I'm loved and accepted by God. Even though I don't do the most fantastic job in the world, I love and accept myself. That was something I was taught, that paradox prayer. And it is amazing how that prayer, and I have to do it sometimes many times a day, it just poofs the false self, and I find out who I really am, the perfectly flawed and the perfectly loved person. I want to read the quote that Steve Strauss shared a few weeks ago in communion that I know a lot of you loved. I asked him for it. It's by another Catholic priest. You know, it's so funny. I used to think the Catholics just, you know, had everything all wrong. And now I'm drawn to the Catholics all the time. You know, God's funny. I think that when I heard this, I thought, that's the true self. So the true self is finding that paradox of being perfectly flawed and perfectly loved and accepted. And the true self is our child of God self, where God's presence lives. And because we're people of the circumference, we don't want to take the time, or we're too afraid to let go of that candy shell, to go through the shame, and to get to the nugget at the center. But the center is where the true life is, where the good stuff really is. And that's a place of peace and freedom. And I think that this little quote sums it up. There is a place in the soul that neither time or space or no created thing can touch. A place in you that has never been wounded, where there is a sureness in you, where there is a seamlessness in you, and where there is a confidence and tranquility in you. And I think the intention of prayer and spirituality and love is now and again to visit that place, that inner kind of sanctuary. End of quote. I think this is the good news of the gospel. I think this is the message of grace, the message of Christ, that there's a place that we can live. I think it's what Jesus meant when he said, abide with me. You know, I've pondered that for years too. A lot of things I've pondered are making sense now. How can we abide with Christ? I think it's when we make a conscious effort to be mindful of living in the presence of God. And that's where the true self is. Death is not a negative, awful thing when we see it in the light of resurrection. Death to our false self is not a terrible, awful thing when we realize that the true self can emerge just like the butterfly or the grain of wheat. So are you willing to let go and surrender the false self so that you may be transformed into the true self? Who are you going to trust? I'm going to share this one last thing. So 9 months ago when I started teaching, I was scared to death to get a job that wasn't ministry related, because all I'd ever done my whole life was ministry. And now I had to get a job out there in the cold, cruel world where all of you have worked for years. And I know my family like shook their head like, what are you afraid of? Like, I was scared to death to do something other than what I'd done my whole life. And so I got this job, and I really felt like God was in it, and I was excited. And then I work in a classroom, a behavioral classroom, with kids with emotional disturbance. When I took the job, you know, I said, well, what, I don't really even know what this is, you know. I was like, don't do that. But anyway, and like, they kind of have bad language sometimes. I thought, well, I can handle that. Oh, my gosh, was it so much more than that, you know, just... And it was exhausting, and it was draining physically. I mean, I had things thrown at me. I had blood that came, and just like, ugh, so many things. And one day, I mean, it was in September, not a couple weeks after I started. And I said to Ray, my husband, like, I'm tired of trusting God. Now, I couldn't believe I said that. But I said, I'm tired of trusting God. I've been trusting God for 7 years. And this, basically, this is what I get, is this job where kids are physically beating me up. And I said, I'm tired of trusting God. And Ray said to me, I'm sure it was the Lord, he said, so who are you going to trust? And I thought, I think I'll stick with God. So who are you going to trust today? Trusting God is surrendering to his love, surrendering to grace, letting go. and today is a good day to die.